Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, clinicians, CEOs, founders, journalists, investors, the list goes on, of people that are changing the UK healthcare system and changing the global healthcare system and building the future of health. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech business myself, which is called PocDoc. And PocDoc is leading the way in cardiovascular screening outside of a GP surgery. We work with 40% of the NHS at this point, and we are the number one diagnostic test on the high street. So if you are open to learning more about your heart health, having a cardiovascular checkup, please go to pocdoc.co and you can look at our healthy heart check. And thank you so much to PocDoc for supporting the show as always. Thank you to everyone who's listening live on the amazing UK Health Radio. We love, love, love UK Health Radio as a live platform. Johan and the team do an amazing job. It's not just the Health Tech Hour that's on UK Health Radio. There are tons of other great shows, so I'd recommend checking them out. Thank you also if you are listening on any of the podcast channels, your podcast channel of choice. We are on all of them and we get downloads in over 50 countries every single month, which absolutely blows my mind. From Vietnam to Venezuela, from Saudi Arabia to another country beginning with S, Spain, that you know, escaped me at that point in time. But we are basically the World Cup of the expanded World Cup format of Health Tech Hour podcasts. Thank you if you're watching on YouTube. Thank you if you are watching on the Instagram channels at Health Tech Hour or my own Instagram channel, which is called Steve Roost. So thank you very much to everyone for joining us. And thank you very much to my guest today, who's Matt Whitty, who, and I'm going to get this right because I wrote it down before the show, who is the Director of Commercial Partnerships at MD Clone, which focuses on self-service data analytics in order to drive safer collaboration and better research. And also, Matt is the ex-Director of Innovation, Research and Life Sciences at NHS England. And it's great to have him on the show. He's a real thinker in the space. And there's a huge amount, if anyone's been paying attention, as a lot of you have done over the last 2 to 3 years, in and around this area of centralized data, the ethics around it, the efficacy around it, what it could unlock, what it can't unlock, what we have to be careful of. It's really great to get Matt on the show. So Matt, welcome to the show. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Delighted to be here. And I love the World Cup reference as well, so it's nice to be part of the World Cup.
Yeah, I don't know quite when, yeah, exactly. This. I know I saw Infantino's talking about the 64 Nation World Cup. So that's kind of where we are every month. So yeah, I thought I would just get that one slipped in. So let's kind of get down to basics, because you have a kind of a real track record of being in the nexus of really interesting, innovative things, whether that's at NHS England or in what you're doing now. And so how did you end up in that position?
Yeah, I guess I had... Yeah, I guess I had a bit of an interesting career journey, really. So I started in the NHS as a pharmacist. So I was a hospital pharmacist. So I was a frontline clinician working in a hospital. And at the time, I just thought that was my career. I'd progress through the hospital doing different roles or maybe specialising in a particular area. But I decided that I wanted to do a little bit more. I wanted to understand how the health system worked, not just kind of the hospital itself. So I guess kind of I first started to kind of get itchy feet and start to think about doing something differently, thinking about moving away from sort of how to support individual patients to how to kind of support a system working. So I moved into working for commissioning organisations to kind of get that more rounded view. I then moved into consultancy. So I worked for one of the big four and then worked for myself. So again, kind of got a different experience about kind of working with people from different backgrounds, different skills. And then moved into a national role at NHS England. So I really wanted to kind of make that impact at scale. And you know, at the time there was no better place to do that really. So moved into exactly as you say, working at the intersection between government, industry, academia, regulatory systems, and patient groups. So it was a fascinating place to work.
There's a lot to unpick there. So I think you kind of glossed over what is a relatively uncommon path from hospital pharmacist or pharmacist or clinician into a central innovation lead. That doesn't, in my experience, that doesn't tend to happen that often. And so why were you the, maybe you weren't the exception and you say, you'll tell me that it happens all the time, but what was it that drove you to make that leap?
So I think probably the main thing is, well, it's probably two things. One, I'm quite a curious person. So I'm very curious about sort of new areas and kind of expanding and, oh, well, what if this happened? Or what if this was a little bit different? Or could I apply skills that I've learned in one area in a slightly different sector or domain? So I've always kind of been a bit like that. And then probably the second thing is that career-wise, I've never really been able to plan my career more than about 3 to 5 years ahead, just because things move so fast, or you know, my interest sort of you know, develops in a new area, really. So I guess that kind of combination of curiosity and medium-term, not long-term planning, I'd say.
And did people think you were kind of crazy, or did they sort of get it when you were trying to make those moves?
No, mostly people thought I was a bit crazy.
Yeah, I bet.
And I, you know, I'd have conversations, and people would say, you know, why, you know, what are you doing now, and what's your career now? And you know, I've had different training as well, so I did some legal training as well. So there's sort of I've always been interested in doing slightly different things. Mostly at the time, people thought I was crazy, but I've always thought they've been calculated risks.
And when you moved to NHS England, which is in the process of being disbanded, we're not quite sure where that. I don't know quite exactly where we are, but that's, I believe that the decision was definitely taken.
Yeah.
The legislation to enable that definitely passed.
It's going
or passing.
Through, it's passing, I think.
Yes.
And I think they're, I think it's next year sometime, early next
right.
year.
When you joined, what was the kind of hypothesis around NHS England? What was the vision? What attracted you there?
So I think one of the things that attracted me there, that there was a I think it was called the 5-year forward view. There was a sort of a long-term strategy document. Research and innovation, which are really important to me, were really kind of central tenets of that plan. And I quite liked that nationally the NHS and government were thinking a bit differently. There was, you know, a much more openness to collaborate with industry and with academia. And these are things that I'd seen as barriers earlier in my career where, you know, either in the NHS where there was, where it maybe wasn't as open to industry, or whether there were sort of tensions between different parts of the NHS or academia and the NHS. So I could see a real kind of change in direction around the time that I joined, and I was kind of keen to play my part.
And what is your, seeing as you just mentioned it there, where do you land now that you're outside of NHS England? Where do you stand on this issue of, and I'll give you my view after you give you yours. I'm not just going to leave you out there to dry and hang you out there to dry. There is a tension between this concept of a public NHS and the private sector, capital P, capital S. What's your take on this whole thing? Because it comes up all the time in the media, and I'd just be curious about your view, seeing as you worked at that nexus.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, really. And I guess I've always been on more kind of the pro-collaboration side, just ideologically, that's where I've sat, really, because I just don't think the NHS can do all the things on its own. You know, we're not developing our own hardware. We can develop some software, and clinicians, you know, have come up with some fantastic ideas for their own software, but we're not doing all of it. You know, we haven't developed our own cloud infrastructure. We haven't developed lots of things, you know, new medicines.
Its own medicines, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so all of these things, we need the skills, the facilities, the external funding sources. There isn't enough money for the government or the NHS to develop all of these things. So I've always wanted to play my part in kind of getting the best of those different sectors into the hands of clinicians and in front of patients.
And what do you think this anti-privatization of the NHS sort of meme or trope is really about? Because I think that most people understand conceptually what you just said, I think, which is, well, the NHS doesn't make drugs. The NHS doesn't make medicines. The NHS doesn't do this. The NHS doesn't make surgical implements, gloves, etc. So it has to work with private companies. So I don't think this anti-privatization is about that, but I'm not quite sure what it is about.
So I haven't quite found the answer, and I've been looking for the best part of a quarter of a century. I think fundamentally it comes down to trust and motivation. And I think that there's a fear that if there's, you know, seen to be excessive profiteering, or if the benefits of, you know, the innovations or the IP or the learning, if that isn't being fed back in to the health system or some other part of society in terms of more people in work or another part of the national infrastructure being improved, I think that's where people start to see the trust and the motivations, lower trust and the distrust of the motivation. So I think that is some of the reason. So I think, you know, some of the places where I've seen the collaborations work well, high degree of trust, very clear understanding of the motivations of each party. You know, what is it that each party is bringing to the collaboration? So those ones tend to work a bit better, but it's still tough.
So do you think it's really more around, I'll use the water companies generically as an example, without, I don't specifically know which water companies, but none of them seem brilliant, to be honest, right now. But the idea that the kind of asset itself is being milked in an extractive way that then diminishes the quality of the provision of the service in the first place, while profiteering some sort of slightly mysterious, nebulous group of people who may or may not even be based in the UK.
I think that's very, very, very much it. And I think, you know, in the area I'm working now with health data, it's sort of even more real for patients, because you're talking about, you know, some of the most sensitive data that people have about them, about their medical conditions or the conditions of their loved ones. So people know there's a value attached to it. And when you ask them, most of the time, most of the surveys, when people ask about how would you like your data to be used, what would you like it to be used for, what do you think about data sharing between healthcare organisations? You know, it's very common for answers for those surveys to come back as to saying, one, aren't you doing this already?
Yeah.
Two, of course I don't mind you doing it, but I want the benefit to come back into either me or the organisation or the system or some public good to come from this. And I was having a conversation with Manchester Foundation Trust recently, and they've done a lot of work engaging with their population across Greater Manchester about this. And they've been looking at sort of the, you know, what are the options for being like a data donor? What's kind of the benefits if patients are happy to give their data, either from, you know, wearables or whatever it may be? You know, what is it that they're getting back, and what is it that they're, how can they be clear about what they're contributing to the community across Manchester? So I think there are some really interesting areas around that.
I think one of the areas that has, I don't know why, but it hasn't been explained, I don't believe, to the general population at large, is who even owns their health data right now, right? Like the concept as to your point, I would think that, and in fact I know, having spoken to lots of people, that they sort of assume that there already is a single patient record, that they sort of are like, well, that, why wouldn't that be the case? Yeah. That would make lots of sense. So then when you start to kind of unpick it for people, and it's like, well, no, actually your GP owns that particular record, but then your hospital might have a separate one, and they just start to kind of question the sanity of that stuff.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. And I think that, you know, I'm speaking about myself in when I was in the NHS as well. I don't think we've done a very good job of explaining that in the conversations. And I remember seeing two juxtaposition news articles in the days before we got our news from Twitter. and the first article was a really tragic case of a patient that had died after suffering an allergic reaction. They were on holiday. They went to a hospital. They were given an antibiotic that they were allergic to. They went into anaphylactic shock. And the general tone of that news article was, isn't it awful that the hospital didn't have access to this patient's primary care record, because they would have known this and they wouldn't have, the patient wouldn't have tragically died. next news article, literally the next news article, was talking about information sharing with a community pharmacy. And the general tone of that one was, isn't it awful that this private sector community pharmacy is going to get hold of your health data? And I remember thinking, this is a really unusual kind of editorial kind of flow, because it's really the same kind of problem.
But I wonder whether that... And we have, by the way, dear listeners, we didn't plan this segue, but it now looks like we may have done, but we didn't. But I think that highlights the conflict of the current debate in the UK about patient data right there.
Yeah.
In those two things, which is, on the one hand, there's, and actually I've often seen it's almost like the similar groups that sometimes end up cycling through these arguments against each other, and it seems very cyclical. So, like, for example, like you said, one day it might be this and then the other day it might be the opposite, and so they're trying to almost reconcile sometimes completely irreconcilable positions into a framework. It seems very fraught at the moment.
Yeah, and I think that the fraughtness tends to be when you kind of forget that, like, what is the patient journey we're trying to enable through all of this? And I think if that's kind of the focus of it, those conversations are 10 times easier than if you come in from a different angle, or if it's not clearly articulated in that way.
And so how does kind of, in your role at MD Clone, how have you guys kind of approached this? Because you're not just the UK, you're in the US and things like that. So there must be a sort of, I'd be curious about what the non-UK versus UK sort of view is around this.
So interestingly, it's firstly, on the international comparison, I'd say there's far more similarities than differences when I look across the different health systems, not in terms of the way they're set up or funded or expectations or outcomes, but in terms of the challenges of using health data. It's really, really similar across different countries. You know, everywhere wants to protect patient data as best they can. Everywhere is sensitive to kind of getting the conversation right about how that's used. Everyone recognises there's value in kind of learning from each patient journey. You know, my personal view is that each patient journey should be an opportunity to improve care for the next patient.
If you were running a business, that is what you use customer interactions to do.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you take out the idea that this is health just for a second, which I know that we can't, so you've got to put it back in at some point. But if you took it out, in theory, each customer interaction teaches you something that you can then improve the delivery of whatever it is you're trying to deliver.
Completely, completely. And this is things that people would expect in all other aspects of life and the companies they interact with or the systems they interact with.
Yeah. So we have to go for our first commercial break, and then we will be right back with the second part of today's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Matt Whitty, who is the commercial director at MD Clone. And we will be right back, and we're going to pick up conversations around this area of something called the Federated Data Platform, which is it's a really hot potato. So it sounds technical, but it's extremely interesting. So we'll be right back.
The station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage, or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of this week's show with my guest today, Matt Whitty from MD Clone. So Matt, what we were talking about just before the break was this kind of fraughtness in and around the kind of concept of patient data that, that in your experience, actually weirdly, the UK isn't particularly out of sync with the rest of the global community in terms of the complexities and the difficulties of being able to unlock this value. What has been done? Because a term that gets thrown around a lot, it's quite a kind of buzzword at the moment, is FDP. So, it means federated data platform. So like, is that the answer? And if so, what is that? Or is that just kind of like a well-meaning plan that isn't really going to come to fruition? And, you know, then we'll come on. Because yeah, what's your kind of take on this whole thing?
Yeah, so I think the Federated Data Platform was a nationally commissioned platform commissioned by NHS England a few years ago with the aim of joining up health data across multiple sites, but kind of keeping it local, but having a way for organisations to kind of learn from each other to improve direct care and to support planning for the patients in mm-hmm. those areas. So that was what it was set up for. And I guess at MD Clone, we do something similar for some of the ways. So one of the things that we do with our platform is that we've effectively got an Ask Me Anything platform for clinicians working within a hospital to be able to extract the data from the clinical systems, to be able to analyze it within the platform easily without technical skills. The sort of the alternative way for doing this would be for a clinician to ask the business intelligence team for information, and then there'd be a back and forth, and that might take weeks or months. Mm-hmm. By which point, kind of, you might get the information after the time to act has already gone. So we're kind of an on-demand way for clinicians to be able to access that themselves. So we kind of solve the problem that the FDP solves for those kind of internal hospital use cases, but in a slightly different way. I'd say the bit that we also do differently is that we've got additional privacy enhancements built in, kind of thinking back to kind of the trust conversation that we had earlier. So one of the things that we can do in the platform is that we enable hospitals to develop, to create their own synthetic data. So what I mean by that is data that is fake patient data, generated from the original data loaded into the platform. So the advantage of this is that it gives you extra privacy. So there's no one-to-one linkage between.
There's no identifiers, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So this unlocks sort of safer collaboration with across the ecosystem. So this could be a hospital working with its academic partners, mm-hmm. and they can do so much more safely on synthetic data because there's a lower risk of being re-identified.
And do you? So it sounds like to me the concept of the FDP, the hypothesis behind it, you agree with, I think. But I'm taking a bit of an extrapolation there.
Yeah, so I'll answer it in two parts because it's a really tricky area. So I completely think that the NHS should have much more joined up use of data, and I think we need safer ways for organisations to collaborate on their data across the systems. I think the criticisms I've seen of Palantir, who are the company that won the FDP, tend to be around some of the personal opinions of the leadership there, particularly around sort of the NHS as an entity.
Because they commissioned it, you mean? Or what do you mean?
So I think they've previously been sort of, I can't remember the exact quote, but there were quotes around, you know, that were anti the NHS in a sense.
Oh, okay.
So the owners, the founders' positions were anti NHS. So I think.
Oh, like sort of like the NHS. I'm not saying they said this just for clarity. Yeah. I'm saying something like they sort of referred to it as socialism type trope.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So I think there's sort of a group of arguments around kind of that. There's arguments around sovereignty and actually whether non-British companies should kind of be part of the ecosystem around certain types of infrastructure. So there's sort of a group of people that are maybe looking at it from that angle.
So that's the sort of angle where people are sort of communicating that the NHS health data is an unbelievable resource. Effectively, yes. It's a national resource because we're one of the few. Well, are we the largest per capita single healthcare system in the world, potentially?
I think we are.
Right? Probably.
Yeah.
I'm just guessing. Certainly public. So it's like an unbelievable resource that we should be managing, controlling, monetizing for the benefit of the UK and its patients.
Exactly. And I guess my kind of view on it would be, one, I think it's definitely right that we should enable clinicians working in hospitals to have better ways to kind of join up care for the patients that they serve. And that's one of the things that the FDP was looking to do. Two, I also think nationally, it's perfectly fine for government or NHS England or whatever follows NHS England to commission things nationally and to go out and use their monopsony buying power to get great deals on technology that they think can help solve their aims, as long as it's done through due process and all of those kind of things. So I don't have any issues with that at all. So I think that's really important.
Why then do you think people have been so against the Palantir deal? I mean, I when I say people, I mean I see articles in the health trades and also in the national media almost universally. So I haven't seen many, if any, articles or people outside of Palantir itself speaking positively about it.
Yeah, I mean,
so what do you think is going on?
I think it probably links into some of the comments of the leadership there. I think it's probably also some of the kind of the, you know, the some who are just sort of some people who are just generally don't like external companies coming into the NHS. Hmm. I think also kind of the range of sectors that the winner of that tender works in. So not just working in health, and particularly kind of military use can be a bit controversial for some people. So I think those are some of the things I've seen people talk about.
And why, put it very bluntly, do you think an American company, let me dial it back. I have seen, I think, lots of businesses, UK businesses, say at least that they could do the same thing. I'm not an expert in this space, right? It's not my area, but I feel like there's quite a few players. So what do you think, why didn't one of them get it? Is there truly a skills gap or an aptitude gap or a quality gap between where the UK equivalents are to something like Palantir? If you strip out all the politics and all of the noise, is there genuinely like an actual technical gap?
I don't think there is. I think, and you know, going through the procurement process, I think there were other consortia or groups of technology companies coming together to try and.
Okay.
So I don't think it was.
Oh, so it wasn't a one horse race? It was an actual tender?
There was a tender, yeah.
Oh, right. I didn't know that. Do you know what? That's weird, because everything that I read is almost makes it look like there wasn't a tender.
Yeah, no, there definitely was a tender. So I don't know the details of what one was selected over the other, but there was definitely a tender. I mean, the one thing I would say with Palantir is that they did win. They have won other similar big contracts in other countries as well.
Yeah,
so they are good at winning this type of work.
And leaving aside the Palantir thing, are you a favor? Because there are regions like Greater Manchester and Northeast North Cumbria and probably others that I'm not aware of who have gone ahead and developed their own regional FDP. Irrespective of the national FDP. Yeah. So they've invested their own cash, resources, time, effort, etc. into that. So where do you stand on this regional versus national? Or do those things kind of end up merging at some point? Or like, how does that happen? Or have we duplicated effort?
I think they end up sort of converging, then unconverging, diverging.
Yeah.
From memory, I think when the FDP was going out, it was seen as very much it's being bought nationally. You can use it locally if you want, but you may have other solutions that better suit your needs.
Okay.
And then I think the national message changed a bit to you must use it. And then, so I think over time, you know, the organizations locally that are making these decisions, so you're making decisions over many, many years. And you often don't want to kind of undo what you've already done, or you've already invested in, or you might not be able to. So I think it sort of diverges and converges throughout, really.
Well, I think what's interesting is that, and this, I think this is happening probably outside of the media. I haven't really heard much about this, but regions want to use their local FDPs to bring in research funding from pharma, from others, right? So in a weird way, they're sort of in the market of leveraging that asset already.
Yeah, and I think that's a key point. So certainly Ming Tang, who was the former chief data and analytics officer for NHS England, who was leading the work around the FDP. She was always very clear that the FDP was not for research purposes. It wasn't for sort of collaboration and innovation kind of purposes. It was much more direct care and operational planning.
Almost like BI for the... If the NHS was the company, it's BI for the company.
BI, benchmarking, planning, those kind of things. So they were always very clear that that wasn't one of the areas they wanted the FDP
to use. I didn't know that.
So yeah, so and it's where, you know, where I am now at MD Clone, it's one of the areas where we were able to differentiate because we do enable organizations to do that in the UK and elsewhere as well.
So at some point did this kind of purpose kind of diverge as well?
I don't know if it's formally diverged.
I don't think it's formal.
Yeah, there's so much noise around it. It's difficult to know exactly.
And it's very politicized now, right?
Yeah, hugely so.
Which do you believe that's helpful or unhelpful? I sort of know where I am on it, but...
I mean, I think it makes it messier to have the conversation. You know, is it, you know, what is the problem you're trying to solve? Is it the right technology to do it? Can it do it? Is it working? What have we learned from it? Those are the kind of things we should be really focusing on. And I think some of the noise can make that very difficult to kind of focus on that. And those are the more important conversations to have, in my view.
Yeah, I agree. I can't get around... beyond the fact that you need a single patient record, right? Or you need to be moving towards that for lots of different reasons. And then you separately, the system can only improve itself based off of accurate data.
Yes.
So you need a way to surface that internally.
Yes.
And whether that's called FTP or whatever the name is, that's something that will really benefit hospitals and primary care and everybody. And then you've got a national versus regional thing. And then you've got whether it's who helps you develop it. I don't think there's necessarily any real, you know, other things that come into it. And in terms of the last bit as to who helps you, well, if you run a tender process, then that tender process is open to scrutiny and challenge and all kinds of different things in theory, if that process is run correctly.
Exactly right. And I think this is only going to become even more important, particularly on the single patient record. So obviously the single patient record is coming. You know, we've got the NHS online trust that was just created.
Yeah, the online hospital.
So the online hospital. And, you know, I think in terms of sort of the behavior of patients as consumers in terms of sort of going to sort of online digital health companies to access medicines or treatments or diagnostics, we're seeing a sort of an increase in that as well in the UK and everywhere. So all of these things, you need underpinning them sort of good ways to share information so that you can have a better way of understanding like what is happening to that patient.
Yeah, it's tricky. I don't believe that you should be choosing healthcare solutions based off of media headlines.
Completely agree.
I think that puts you in a very tricky position. I'm not saying that Palantir is the right thing or the wrong thing, by the way. I don't know. I don't know the deal. Don't know the tender. Not my area. But creating an environment where it's almost politically impossible for somebody to support that, I don't believe is helpful in a sort of a place where we need to have more discourse.
Agreed. And I think it's slightly changing. So there's been an increase in focus now on... what is the impact it's having? So I'm starting to see much more of that kind of conversation, which I think is helpful for the national conversation.
Yeah, because there was that art where I don't think necessarily anyone involved in that helped themselves with that article where it sort of said that there were all of these benefits and then sort of had to row back on some of that. I don't think that necessarily helped the conversation.
No, I don't know. And there were a lot more caveats in the follow-up version.
There really were. Yeah, right. So we're going to go for our last commercial break with my guest today, Matt Whitty from MD Clone. We will be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Matt Whitty, the Director of Commercial Services at MD Clone, which is one of the leaders in self-service data analytics across the UK and the US. So Matt, I think there's too much negativity in the UK, okay? There's around the healthcare system. There's a lot of sort of pointing at problems and there's not enough kind of thinking about positivity and things like that. So I think the thing that you said earlier, which I've also experienced more broadly, is that compared to other healthcare systems, like it or not, ours is actually quite good in a lot of these areas. Yeah. Like, you know?
Yeah.
And so like, where do you kind of fall on this sort of idea of needing to inject more positivity, or what's your kind of take on the whole thing?
Well, I think I'm a pretty optimistic person anyway, so I kind of like that optimism and drive in. I think working some of the jobs I've had, that's been kind of quite crucial to my own health and well-being, I'd say. So I am positive, and I think now one of the things I always say where I'm at MD Clone now is that I get to run into all the problems I didn't fix in my last job when I was at NHS England, and I think a lot of the friction you see when you're selling into the NHS, some of it is intentional and needed. So you do need safeguards and ways of doing things correctly and assessing whether the things are right to do. So there's always going to be a certain amount of friction, and we're talking about healthcare, and you can't just kind of move fast and break things in healthcare in the same way that you can in other sectors. But I see a lot of the friction there's friction that nobody wants. It's just accidental friction. So it's resubmitting information multiple times just because the process is... don't line up. It's being asked the same question over and over again. It's delays just because people get distracted or the process is painful. So I do see that frustration being more of a shared frustration, and sort of almost kind of recognizing that when you're going through these processes, that actually each party has kind of the same kind of issues, but just coming from a different point of view can be helpful and kind of move away from some of that negativity into some of that positivity. And I think there are reasons to be positive in the NHS. You know, we've got, you know, as you mentioned, the single patient record, I think, is a fantastic thing. We've got the Health Data Research Service that's been announced with £600 million worth of funding from government and Wellcome Trust. So I think there's like really, 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 really good reasons to be optimistic about healthcare in the UK.
Yeah, I agree. I get frustrated with, well, first of all, like you, I'm an optimistic person, and I don't believe negativity, being negative, helps anything. And actually, the more you moan and complain, the more you almost create that reality for yourself, you know, that everything is bad and things like that. You know, the one I like to say all the time is, you know, I didn't start off in health. I've worked in other industries, and this industry is the only one where the government is investing hundreds of millions of pounds a year in agencies and things to actually help businesses scale. Yes. Like, yes. Good luck if you want to go out and sell payroll software to, you know, SMEs. Like, no one's helping you.
Yeah.
You know, that's straight out product market fit, marketing, sales. Like, you know, the market will decide on that one. There's no one helping you. There's no grant funding, you know? So sometimes I feel like people are too quick to kind of dismiss those things. I'm not saying it's easy. It really isn't. But I don't believe the NHS is any harder than any other B2B enterprise vertical.
Yeah. And I think on that actually as well, I certainly thinking back to my NHS England role, particularly around the grant funding, because there are so many grant opportunities. Sometimes it's almost too many grant opportunities. And actually, one of the things that I used to think when, you know, innovators or health tech companies are trying to get into the NHS was like, the grants are there. They're great for specific purposes. If you're developing a new feature or testing or refining the product or checking it works, whatever it may be. But if I become your customer, you've got a problem as a business because I'm not going to sustain it long term. And if you're not using that grant money wisely to actually do the things that you need to develop and refine the product, that is going to be a bit of a trap.
Yeah, I always say that the NHS is actually really good at doing phase ones. Really good.
Yeah.
Really, really good. They in all kinds of places you can find, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30,000 pounds, £40,000 for phase ones in all kinds of different disease areas and use cases, clinical, non-clinical. The real challenge is transitioning from those when they're positive into phase twos and then into business as usual. That's the real challenge. And I would, as much as I love an innovation passport and I love, you know, innovation hubs and all of these different things, all they really focus on is really making it easier to land phase ones. And it's that transition into BAU where you cross over from the innovative bucket into commissioning bucket. And it goes to the, you know, CFO or the investment committee or whatever at the ICB or whoever you ultimately sell into. Those are very, very different decision sets and very, very different people. And so that would be where I would love to see more time, effort, investment, support, because that's really non-intuitive.
I agree, and I think the innovation passport has got the potential to solve some of that as well. So, sort of a decision made by in one area being applicable for multiple organisations. So, a second organisation,
inshallah, if that's how that gets taken up, like
that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
When I was at NHS England, we set up a program. Well, we ran a program called the NHS Clinical Entrepreneurs Program.
Yep. Tony Young. Shout out, Tony Young.
Yeah. Hey, Tony.
Yep.
We had a sort of a spin out of that program called the Insights Program, which was looking at sort of a number of different NHS organizations who were keen to do exactly that to try and reduce it as well.
And I think that's great. And I think that's exactly what I mean about there's a really high number of people and quite a lot of money that's going into the system to help businesses sell into the system, which you don't get in any other vertical.
Yeah,
it doesn't really happen. So it's just more around how we could improve the efficiency around that. But the issue that you've got is there's so many different businesses at so many different stages and everyone's sort of saying, hey, you should help me first. And it's just tricky.
Yeah. And certainly when I was at NHS England, a lot of the role that I was doing where was trying to line up and kind of make sense of some of those funding programs. So obviously there was sort of NHS England led funding, some of which was my own, and it might have been for things like the AI in Health and Care Award, which is a funding program for AI technologies. It might have been working with the National Institute for Health Research on some of their investment programs or for the Small Business Research Initiative. So kind of a lot of what I did was try, like, how can we kind of make this a logical suite of go to this entity for this type of funding if we're trying to solve this kind of problem?
Yeah.
And these are our needs as a non-dilutive investor, basically.
Yeah, I think the system could do a better job of qualifying out things that it doesn't care about.
I mean, a quick no is always better than...
I just feel like it is full of really... pretty much nice people who genuinely want to help, and most people working in health have a product or service that does help in some way, so no one wants to really be like negative about it, and so you end up in the kind of maybe zone where actually there's just stuff that the system in any given region just literally doesn't care about right now. Now you could argue that they should care, that's fine, but they just don't. So it's, I don't know, just I feel like sometimes things get sustained a bit longer than they should do.
Yeah. And I think that sort of, you know, an early go, no go decision on a lot of this stuff would have been great. I probably should have done that.
Yeah. I mean, but it's hard because everyone cares and everyone wants, and for the most part, everything that everyone's doing is net positive.
Yeah.
So it's not like anyone's, you know, there's no clinical issue that isn't urgent.
Yes, yeah.
Really, in the grand scheme of things, particularly not if you're a patient, it's just that the system has sort of a rank-ordered list of priorities. So what's the kind of future hold for MD Clone? Like what's getting you excited about the next, the next 3 to 5 years?
So, I'm really excited about, you know, the single patient record. I'm really excited about the health data research service and where this goes. So I see lots of kind of Really important kind of strategic decisions have been made by government and by NHS England that are really looking to maximise the way in which data supports patient care and research and innovation. So I'm excited about kind of the direction of travel that we've seen. Obviously, the proof will be in the pudding. We've got a fantastic piece of work and a partnership that we're working on with Manchester Foundation Trust at the moment across all of the areas I mentioned. So clinician-led quality improvement, faster research, safer collaboration across the ecosystem there. Looking to collaborate with Manchester Foundation Trust and with other NHS partners over the next few years, and doing it at both at kind of bigger scale, because I really do think that, particularly on the research side, you know, this is an internationally competitive field. You know, the competition isn't the hospital down the road in the way it is. It's we are on an international game, and from a research perspective, we're taking a lower share of research than we ever have.
Is that right?
Yeah, even though we've got, particularly for sort of the phase three and phase four studies.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
So we're getting a declining share.
And why is that, do you think?
I think it's the rise of other bigger markets that are able to do faster, or maybe they've got a different kind of social contract with their population about what data can be used. And I think speed has been a bit of a challenge for us as well. So we've always had kind of good quality research, very, very high quality research, fantastic world-class academic institutions.
Yep.
But I'd say the speed that we can do here is not as fast as other places. And that's something that I'm excited that MD Clone can help with as well, because of the way in which we can help organizations get use of the data they already hold.
Yeah. So how does it speed stuff up?
So I think now when you some of the early questions that you're looking to answer, you know, you just sometimes just want to know, have you got the right patients there? Have you got the sufficient number of patients here? So having a way of doing that without having to go backwards and forward with the BI team can be really helpful. I think on synthetic data as well, it's a really good kind of first enabler. So one of the challenges that we see is if you think about kind of using real patient data, that's, you know, high bars are needed around that.
Huge safety risk.
Then you see around de-identified data. So that's where the identifiers are stripped out. And that would be gold standard ways for data sharing in the US, in the UK, and in Europe, and really, really everywhere. But we've known with de-identified data that even though itself isn't, there's no identifiable data in there, with additional data, you can start to re-identify that patient record.
Right.
So we saw potential examples of this recently with UK Biobank.
Yeah, I was going to mention there was a couple of really bad ones there.
So UK Biobank, there was an article in The Guardian, I think, and they were saying that some of the data had got onto, some of the de-identified patient data from Biobank had got onto GitHub.
Yeah.
Some of it was being sold on Alibaba.
Yeah.
And various places like that.
So, which, let me just so we're clear, that's about as bad a data breach as you could get.
Yeah, it's...
To find patient data being sold on a marketplace is about as bad as you could hope to get.
I would say so. I would also say that, firstly, I mean, what UK Biobank does is a fantastic institution. It's really, really important. Actually, you know, we work globally and we could see kind of the shockwaves of some of this in other places. The data there was de-identified data. The challenge is that can be re-identified if additional data is, if it can be triangulated with additional data. So there was another article by Polly Toynbee who was talking about this. I don't know if you saw this, but she was saying in support of UK Biobank, you know, I'm in the UK Biobank. It's an important institution.
Yep.
You know, my data's in there. It's all de-identified. I'm a cancer survivor. I had surgery. And then all of a sudden, you're starting to add in additional data points. So one, you're in the data set. Two, you've had a particular type of diagnosis. Three, you've had a particular type of treatment.
Right.
So the more of those things you add in, the higher risk of re-identification. And this has been known for years. So one of the great things that we can enable organizations to do is to generate synthetic data. So most organizations that we work with load de-identified data into the platform, all behind the organization's firewall. We're not touching the data. And then they can generate synthetic data from that. So it kind of removes the risk of that re-identification.
Just to get into this concept of synthetic data, because this has been around for a really long time.
Yeah.
Really, really long time. It underpins a huge amount of machine learning and AI, and not just in health, just in the concept of the generation of synthetic data to increase the data set so that your model can be trained and improved. Yes. Basically, you take real data and then you use it to synthesize more data that looks like the real data so that you can get a more accurate model. How do you actually do that? So you've got patient data where you've de-identified it. Obviously, no name, no postcode, no date of birth, and whatever other things that we strip out. What then needs to be synthesized? Do you just copy it over and create a new record of the same thing? So like what actually happens?
There's an algorithm that kind of matches the patterns within the data. So it's the patterns that you're looking for within the data. And as well as kind of the algorithm that does that, there's also additional techniques that we use, MD clones. So we've got obfuscation techniques. We will remove outliers from the data. We will suppress small numbers if the outputs are too small as well. So there's sort of multiple layers of privacy. And I think the thing that I'd sort of say that I've sort of seen over the last few years is that I've had lots of interesting conversations about synthetic data versus other sort of privacy enhancements or real data. But I think the real question is, why not use synthetic data first where you can?
Yeah.
Because there's no risk.
Zero risk.
Particularly when you combine it with a tool where you can, like ours, like our Adams platform, which means that you can get this on demand straight away, and save the real data or the de-identified data where you really need that kind of patient level data. And you touched on machine learning. It's a big sort of increasing area that we're seeing for use around kind of training algorithms. We've done work with the FDA in the US on training algorithms on synthetic data that we've enabled them to generate. And it's an increasing area, I think, that the UK is looking at. I know MHRA is looking at sort of more kind of sandbox environments as well.
I think one of those creating sandbox environments is, I've talked to a number of people, is like if you really wanted to accelerate the pace of health tech in the UK, create some sandbox environments where people can API in and they can use synthetic data that's from trusts or ICBs or both or primary care and just let people go at it before they need to engage in any regulatory process.
Completely.
Like, you know, I love anything that helps innovation scale. I really do. Innovator passports and so on and so forth. But actually, I feel like sometimes those are easier things to solve than the real underlying environmental conditional things, market conditional things that are actually really hard, but actually would have a huge... If you wanted to create the UK as the number one place to build digital health or health tech, having sandbox environments that somehow plug into large data lakes of synthetic healthcare data, every single health tech business would go here.
Completely agree.
Every single one. There, it wouldn't even be close. Because there wouldn't even be any other market. Because even in the US, all the data is owned at the hospital level. And each hospital is really like closed walls. So you'd get a lot of those guys coming over and doing it
here.
Yes,
yeah, we would. And we've got a really diverse population here as well.
Huge.
Yeah, so we've got...
You've got 70 million people. Yeah. I mean, that's a massive population of huge like differences in socioeconomic group, in ethnicity, it would be amazing. But that's quite hard to solve.
It is. I mean, I've done some thinking about this, obviously, with my MD clone hat on. And, I'm thinking, if you get, sort of five hospitals collaborating together in a way and with all of the safety and the governance around the data, that becomes sort of an important national asset. If you get 10, that becomes a world leading asset.
Yeah, it's nearly 5 million people, right?
Yeah.
Give or take. Depends on who you get, right?
You probably get
3 to 5,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, I agree. So how do we make that happen, Matt?
Well, I think regulators and HDR, MHRA and HDRS are kind of exploring this as well. But, obviously I think they should, they should run a competition. And I think MD Clone should be in the conversation.
You should. I've got two more questions. So what do you think of the decision to abolish NHS England?
So it's interesting, and I think there's two parts to it. I think the one is the decision itself, and two is the way the decision was communicated. So it was so I think on the decision itself, I think it's a completely understandable decision. I did see duplication when I worked at NHS England between some of the work that the department was doing at the Department of Health or NHS England was doing, and I can see politically why if you're the Secretary of State for Health. But you've got effectively an arm's length body that you're on the hook for doing it, but you've got very limited tools to manage it. That is politically difficult, politically difficult situation to do. So I can sort of see why they did it, and I certainly saw the duplication. I think the challenge they've got now is that if you bring it in house, all of a sudden you don't have the excuse. You are accountable for it.
So you're on the hook.
So there is that you all of a sudden you don't have that almost political deniability because you are the person. So. I suspect these things will fluctuate as we see in healthcare over sort of, 10, 15 years. There'll probably be some outsourcing of some elements of it to you know, maybe, I don't know, for life services or something will be spun out of it again. So I think we're very much in kind of centralising, and whether that remains under Burnham longer term, I don't know, because, you know, given his role in devolution.
Who knows?
We'll just have to see. Yeah.
Who knows? But I think, I think we could talk about this for ages. We're going to have to close the show. But I would say, word of warning, devolution in health is not all it's cracked up to be, in my experience. You know, I think careful what you wish for.
I can't wait for the next podcast to go.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we could do another one, but I've been spending a lot of time outside of England at the moment. And, you know, to the point I made earlier, England's NHS may not necessarily stack up quite as badly as people think to other healthcare systems. Let's just put it that way. Right. So, Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show. And thank you to everyone for listening. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure.
Brilliant. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week with another show.